I call this meeting of the Health Finance Policy Committee to order. Today is Monday, April 7th. And first order of business is the approval of minutes from April 2nd. Representative Hewitt, have you had a chance to review the minutes for April 2nd, please?
Mr. Chair, I have, and so moved.
Representative Hewitt moves the approval of the minutes for April 2nd. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? And the motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Members, we have a full agenda today, so we'll be asking members and testifiers to please keep your remarks concise. And moving directly, 2 minutes is preferred for testifiers as well. We'll have a timer going, so when you hear the alarm, please wrap up your comments. First bill on the agenda, Representative Ryer, House File 2779. Vice Chair Ryer, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move my House File 2779 to be laid over.
Vice Chair Ryer moves that House File 2779 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Vice Chair Ryer, I understand you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Ryer moves the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Aye.
The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. To your bill, Vice Chair Ryer, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Backer and committee members. Access to health care is critical for each of us individually, for our families, and for our communities. And we know that for all of us in our real lives, access comes down to 4 things. Adequate insurance coverage, affordable care, services and facilities available within a reasonable distance, and the way you're treated by your healthcare professionals, that they're able to take the time and care they think they need. Across the country and in Minnesota, these aspects of access are being threatened by consolidation and the rising cost of care. Health spending in Minnesota rose by over 15% between 2019 and 2022. Price increases drove this. The amount of care delivered went up by less than 1%. Spending up 15%, care up 1%. This rise in prices is due in large part to a decades-long trend of consolidation across hospitals, clinics, insurers, and more, resulting in mega systems with incredible market power. From 2016 to 2023, there were 22 mergers, acquisitions, and other changes in ownership involving Minnesota hospitals, leaving many communities with access to 1, maybe 2 health systems. Consolidations like these lead to higher prices and do not improve quality of care. And then when private equity is involved, there's evidence of deeply troubling outcomes for patients and communities. Higher mortality rates, hospitals and nursing homes driven into the ground and shuttered, prices hiked and claims denials increased at the same time. And regardless of who's behind the money, it's the way that investors and owners exploit healthcare practices for profit that's problematic. That's what this bill aims to address. House File 2779, the Healthcare Accountability Act, addresses problems with our existing level of consolidation and corporate investment in healthcare. It increases transparency and strengthens protection against corporate interference in our medical care. Article 1 addresses gaps in transparency around ownership and financing of health systems. These additions ensure that we see the relationships within our increasingly complex, vertically and horizontally integrated healthcare systems. Because it's in these relationships among the different owned and contracted entities that companies can extract wealth from healthcare. It's happened in other states across the country, and we want to be ahead of that trend in Minnesota. Article 2 ensures that when entities invest in healthcare practices, they don't control or interfere with actual clinical decisions and care. Minnesota prohibits this kind of corporate practice of medicine, as do most states, but our prohibition comes largely from case law. This bill gives corporate practice of medicine its own section and updates and clarifies protections against modern abuses, such as setting quotas or limits on certain diagnoses or services, limiting the amount of time a provider can spend with a patient, or setting up sweetheart deals with subcontractors to siphon resources. Corporate profit interests are interfering in our medical care and putting healthcare costs out of reach, and we need to stop them. This bill is a much-needed and, I hope, bipartisan step to catch up to the ways in which our healthcare provider landscape has changed and to make sure we have the tools we need to stop financial interests from excessively driving up the cost of care. In closing, this is a complex and urgent area of law, and I'm looking forward to the discussion today. And I'm also eager to keep working on this bill through the interim to safeguard Minnesota patients and healthcare resources, and I welcome all interested parties to the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ryer. We will now move to testifiers. First testifier up, Ms. Leslie Kaup. Please introduce yourself for the committee, Ms. Kaup, and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Kaup. I live in Albert Lea. I am testifying on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. Our union represents over 55,000 workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. For 10 years, I worked as a cook at the Albert Lea Mayo Hospital. Now I work in home care. Please support House File 2779 because too much corporate power has harmed healthcare and workers in my small city. Big corporations have the power to uproot and rearrange critical healthcare services for whole communities, almost without any checks by state or local governments. In 1996, Mayo bought the Albert Lea Hospital, promising world-class healthcare services would continue, even expand. But gradually, Mayo has chipped away at healthcare in our community. In 2017, they announced that we would lose the intensive care unit, overnight medical surgical stays, and the birthing unit. By 2019, those were gone. We now have only an emergency department, same-day surgery, mental health treatment, and addiction treatment, but for men only. Albert Lea is only part of the picture. At least 17 small towns in our region have been closed by Mayo since 2017. On a personal level, these same corporations have even more power over our relationships with our healthcare providers. I've lived in this area for about 15 years, and I've lost count of how many different healthcare providers I've seen. A couple of years ago, after more than 2 years of working in a hospital during the COVID pandemic, I was dealing with pretty severe anxiety issues, and I dropped down to part-time and finally made an appointment with someone I'd never met, a physician's assistant, to talk about several issues, including anxiety and heart palpitations. She was great, and she really listened, and it worked with me to figure out what I needed. But a few months later, I got a familiar message in my patient portal that this provider was moving and that I should book my next appointment with yet another stranger. This bill is a small step. It does not limit the power of big corporations over our healthcare, but it allows the public to see better just who is making the decisions. When we don't know if a global hedge fund is calling the shots for our local hospital, we cannot know how to fight back. This bill may not mean corporations and investors won't have any influence over our medical providers, but it will protect our medical providers' rights to use their medical judgment to decide our health care, and that protects all of us. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kaup. Next testifier, Dr. Alida Borod. She will be on Zoom.
Yes, thank you.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes. Chair Bierman and Backer and committee members, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Alida Borod, a physician advocate for rural health care. We urgently need this bill, as spoken to understand who owns and controls our health care system, given that with increasing consolidation, we've seen higher costs and loss of patient access. You have already heard how vertical integration creates pharmacy deserts. A Lamerton area farmer with diabetes told me that after his local clinic closed along with the Springfield Hospital, he wasn't sure he could keep farming. He knew if he suffered a diabetic coma or an accident on the farm without speedy access to health facilities, he would die. These closures occurred in the most highly consolidated region of Minnesota, the same one that Ms. Kaup spoke to, the Southeast. Consolidation fed high-priced, high-cost referrals to the mothership while devastating the local healthcare infrastructure and the jobs and the tax base that it created. Industry will argue the economic necessity of consolidation, but actual data disproves this. A Brown University study reviewed Medicare claims, which documented increased referrals to higher-priced facilities under private equity ownership and consolidation. This resulted in higher profits through unnecessary facility fees, but not improved outcomes. The Journal of the American Medical Association also showed that private equity may hold assets in a subsidiary to obscure who actually makes decisions. Private equity may purchase the real estate of a hospital, then sell it off to pay its own investors, saddling the hospital with hefty lease payments leading to bankruptcy and closure. Many of our rural hospitals operate in the red, making them vulnerable to takeover. Please use your power to demand transparency and accountability from these owners of our healthcare system to protect the health of all Minnesotans. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Board, for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on House File 2779? Seeing none, we will move to discussion of the bill. Chair Backer.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. Vice Chair Ryer. My question is, I see in this bill that it has a $10,000 revenue. Does that revenue, so if a identity has, I'm sorry, not 10,000, 10 million, okay, I'll get it right, 10 million, is that just revenue from the state of Minnesota, or how about if they have out-of-state stuff, would that include that type of revenue?
Vice Chair Iyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Backer. I actually would like to clarify that with House Research.
And House Research is Ms. Mock. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Fiscal is not here today to help clarify that, but we can get back to the committee with that information.
Thank you, Ms. Mock. Follow up, Chair Backer.
Okay. My next question would do is, you know, it seems to, and I've heard the testifier, I live in Greater Minnesota, so I understand the concerns that they have, but if we put more restrictions on these organizations of people who could get involved and help, your amendment limits it to just physicians and so forth. So when you start limiting who can be involved with that process, asking for more information about who they are, that seems like there would be less care provided because there would be less people, less individuals getting involved with health care with capital improvements and owning clinics and stuff like that.
Vice Chair Iyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The intent is that we aren't saying, I'm not saying that we can't, organizations can't invest, that they can't come in, that they can't make a difference. I've talked to different organizations across the spectrum, ambulatory surgery centers, for example, radiology groups, who've spoken to me about how valuable the investments that they get are to be able to stay cutting edge. You'll see that I'm not saying in these bills that they can't do that. I'm saying that we need to let doctors make the medical decisions, the medical professionals make the care decisions, and that's established in case law, and that's a generally accepted concept for care in organizations. You don't want to have an administrator making your medical decisions. So my intent, and if I'm, you know, we're going to be working on this, so come join me, because the intent is to go through those details and make sure that all of the provisions truly match, making it easier to find out who owns what and what are the implications. Because I'm going to tell you, I spent a good long evening, multiple hours, trying to figure out the ownership structure behind some home health organizations. And I was triangulating from one set of information to another. going through financial databases and the like, and it was really hard to find out whether or not it was owned by a major corporation, private equity, and so forth. Well, why might I want to know that? For example, my mother-in-law just moved into an assisted living, and to be able to say, what is the reputation of the organization that owns and funds this, how do they do, is really important to people. I'm thinking about the consumers in Minnesota who want to be able to understand what's happening in our healthcare system.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Do you have
just one
question?
Quick follow-up. One thank more? You, Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. You know, and understand you want to see who's involved. At the same time, you know, if I'm an investor in a company, and if I want it to be anonymous, make sure my name's not out there, we are stepping on that person's privacy right. We have to be concerned about that, and that itself is not fair, too. So there is work on this bill.
Vice Chair Ryer, comment if you wish, or we can move on. We do have another question, Representative Van Binsberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've owned healthcare companies in the past, and you know I've always been very forthright about my information. I've supplied my information. They've known that I'm the owner, so I'm just a little foggy on. Is it just you haven't? People just don't have the right spot to look. Can you explain a little more of this to me?
Representative or Vice Chair Iyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. It has become increasingly opaque. I think when you're talking about a sole proprietor or someone who owns a few different facilities or companies, it's quite simple. But what's happening is that multiple LLCs are getting created. People are, different parts of the business are going different directions. So the same company may own the hospital. They, through other devices, may even own the real estate, may own the group that is doing the hiring the physicians. And so you get all of these things, but if it's not transparent, we've seen in reports where this isn't private equity, but United Health Group employs more physicians than any other source in the country, and they pay them more than they pay other physicians. So without having that transparency, I don't think people can make a judgment, and our company runs on our country runs on transparency and being able to make informed decisions.
Representative Van Binsbergen, follow up?
No, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I might be able to shed a little bit of light on this question as well. Before coming to the legislature, I worked as an information architect at Optum Health for about 7 years. And one of the little side projects I got assigned to along the way was for a division of Optum Health that sent nurses, nurse practitioners into nursing homes. And the people who had to maintain the database, current database of nursing homes, so they would know where to send people, just couldn't keep track of the nursing homes. So I helped, we looked in the national NPI directory for information. We looked online at the CMS databases on nursing homes where you find the rankings of nursing homes for the like. And it turned out to be a devilishly difficult project because especially with respect to the NPI directory, it's all self-maintained, and frequently the information you would find there wouldn't reflect the current ownership of the facility. So this is, as Representative Ryer is saying, is a very complicated endeavor to try and just figure out who owns this place right now because there's such a lag in updating those records when they change hands.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. I think we are up to final comments. Vice Chair Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the questions and comments. I am very serious about spending time on this, and I know that there are a lot of knowledgeable people around the table and in the community, so I look forward to working together come interim and into next year.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ryer. I renew the motion that House File 2779 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. And Vice Chair Ryer can stay right where you are, and we will move on to House File 1645. Vice Chair Ryer, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move House File 2779 to be laid over.
Vice Chair Ryer moves that House File 1645. We move the bill 1645 before us to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Vice Chair Ryer, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1645 funds a grant for Treat Yourself First, an initiative to address healthcare worker burnout and increased rates of mental health concerns among our healthcare providers. The purpose is to connect workers with resources and reduce the stigma for healthcare workers getting medical health, mental health care when needed. Rates of burnout in healthcare fields were at record highs before the COVID pandemic, and those rates and associated mental health concerns have reached crisis level since. More specifically, results from a survey among nurses indicate that two-thirds of nurses experience severe burnout. A 2023 report found that more than 40% of dentists felt defeated and wanted to quit dentistry. 74.9% of community pharmacists have experienced symptoms of burnout. Almost half of surveyed PAs report experiencing symptoms of burnout or report being completely burned out. And 48.2% of physicians reported experiencing burnout in 2023. 20% of physicians say they are depressed, but only 15% of physicians have sought professional help. This is largely due to the stigma among healthcare workers about getting mental health treatment. Not only are healthcare workers experiencing severe mental health concerns, healthcare workers are leaving the field at record rates because of this. If healthcare burnout isn't addressed, Minnesota won't have enough healthcare workers left, especially in our rural and traditionally underserved communities. We can and must address this. And now I'd like to invite our testifier, Dr. Michelle Chestovich, to speak.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ryer. And Dr. Chestovich, please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for listening to my testimony today. My name is Michelle Chestovich, and I'm a family physician here to testify on behalf of the MMA in support of House File 1645. Rates of burnout are at an all-time high in medicine. It is a real problem with real consequences. We need to support healthcare workers to address their own symptoms of burnout, or frankly, there won't be many of us left. National data shows that rates of early retirement, medical school dropouts, and suicide among physicians and physicians in training are at an all-time high. The same survey shows that 80% of physicians agree there remains a stigma around seeking mental health treatment, and that is what this bill aims to address. Nearly 6 in 10 physicians have reported symptoms of burnout, including severe anger, tearfulness, or anxiety at work. One-third have felt hopeless and that they have no purpose. And more than half know a physician who has considered, attempted, or died by suicide. It is estimated that 1 million Americans lose their physician to suicide each year. These statistics are startling, but what I want to share is that they are also personal. My sister, Dr. Gretchen Butler, was a radiologist in the Twin Cities with a loving family and 3 young children and a successful practice. She was admired by patients and colleagues alike. She unexpectedly died by suicide March 5th, 2021. As physicians, we are not always the best patients. We are trained to solve problems and take care of others. There remains a stigma in asking for help, particularly around mental health issues, and this must change. Many of these stories are about physicians, but similar reports exist for other provider groups. If we continue to see rates of burnout increase, patients across the state will suffer because they can't see a doctor or a nurse or a pharmacist. Thank you for your consideration of this bill, and I'd be happy to help answer any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Chesevich, and sorry for your loss. Any other members or any other people in the public who wish to testify on this bill, please? Seeing none, we will move to member questions. And first up, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the doctor, just curious, you said you're practicing, is that right?
I am currently not in clinical medicine. I 3 years ago stepped away, and I now coach burnt out physicians.
Okay, I think you'll be knowledgeable enough to tell me. In any
20 years I practiced.
Yeah, medicine. You're good. So in any system that we're seeing today, like when I go see my physician or nurse practitioner, how many patients do they see on an average day, and how much time do they actually get to spend with their patients?
That's a really good question. As a primary care doc, I can speak to what I did. I would see typically between 22 to 28 patients a day in an eight-hour day. Many people inappropriately scheduled for 15 minutes because that was the time allotted to deal with their diabetes, hypertension, so on and so forth. So that's what I know. My sister, who's a dermatologist, we're all in medicine. She's a dermatologist. She sees far greater number of patients than that. I mean, she's seeing patients every probably 7 minutes throughout the day. So is it enough time to adequately deal with the very complex patients that we have? I would say absolutely not. We want to give more time and energy, but we have, you know, they just keep coming.
Representative Hewitt,
sorry,
follow up.
Mr. Cherry, real quick, and again, that's just one of the things that I've also heard about. And then on top of it, you have to deal with unreasonable amounts of paperwork and for the pharmacies that call for more, and
yeah,
then the disappointment you have with telling patients that we can't do this, that we're going to have to look for other pathways that are mostly in regulatory bodies. Am I right?
I'm 100%.
Dr. Chesevich?
Yes, I would say 100%. We want to be able to do more for our patients, but we have so many more patients in line. Patients are sending messages. We're trying to deal with that at night. Most of the people that I work with now are spending 5 to 20 hours outside of their week doing their charting and getting back to patients and refills and things like that. So I would say it's a broken system, and yet the care and compassion to take good care of patients is definitely there.
Representative Hewitt?
I'm good, Mr. Chair. Thank you, and thank you to the testifier, and
I am
sorry about your loss.
Thank you.
Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. I guess I just want to acknowledge that any time that we're going to talk about death by suicide, we also acknowledge that we have 988, which is a suicide prevention hotline. I think it's just really important to know that though this is something that is an epidemic in our community, I think it's also important that we highlight the resources that we have in the state, 988, the suicide prevention hotline.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Bierman. And this may be for the vice chair more than the testifier, and again, sorry for your loss. As an EMS, I understand the data shows that healthcare workers, we don't have a whole lot of healthcare workers, doesn't matter if it's nurses, EMS, or doctors. So I get the burnout. I know how many hours I volunteer when I'm back in the district, but we don't need an education program about burnout, in my opinion. We need to raise the supply of healthcare providers. I don't know why we're not looking at Nurses Compact.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you want that for Director Chu, Dr. Chesevich, or
yeah,
Vice Chair?
Vice Chair
Ryer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Backer. Well, I think it's both and, for one thing. We have to support the people who are practicing right now in our state. And as to the Nurse Compact, that's not the bill in front of us today. Thank you.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Bierman. And so I am not sure who the question would be for, so I'm just going to just make a comment quick, and then I'm also just curious to understand the process with licensing a little bit. So globally, 40% of workers globally feel burned out. And I just looked up a Forbes report that indicated that 66% of Americans are experiencing some sort of burnout. So my question is in the medical field with licensed care, you know, healthcare professionals, is there any contraindication or is there anything that would say if I go seek help for burnout or anxiousness or a divorce or something like that, could that impact their license, them being able to practice their license? That's my question.
Representative Ryer or?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. When I was preparing for this, one, there's the stigma aspect of it, of course, which would just undermine confidence. But I was looking and seeing that licensing is now not looking backwards. It's not saying, have you ever? It's saying, do you currently now have a condition, medical, mental health, substance abuse, what have you? I think that there's an effort to undo the structural aspects of stigma. And also, I think, knowing that there's support from people who are in your professions, who have the same kind of feeling like they shouldn't need to get help mm-hmm. because they're caregivers, I think that it helps. Doctor?
I can just speak to the physician. Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you. I can just speak to the physician part. I don't know about the licensure of the nursing and the pharmacist, but a couple of years ago in Minnesota, the state board did take away the stigmatizing language of have you ever had a problem? So now it's more current. Are you able to take care of patients safely? Some of the hospitals, I mean, every hospital in their credentialing can do it their own way. So I don't know of all the hospital systems and clinics in the state if it's past that it's more the destigmatizing language. That being said, I hear since I work with physicians every day now as a coach to try to help people overcome, people are afraid. They're afraid to reach out to their EAP. They're afraid to show that they have weakness because they, even though maybe they're protected by the state board licensure, they're afraid that they're gonna lose their job.
Follow up, Rep. Gilman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for that. I think that's the underlying piece that we have to, in my opinion, wouldn't need this bill for that. I'd rather take that $1 million and help the actual workforce. I mean, understanding the process that if they're fearful even for today to go in and get help or get some support in, you know, if they could lose their license or it could be suspended. I mean, we're seeing this in aviation, trying to figure out how we support our peace and police officers, our volunteer in our fire departments. It's all around in these high stress, life changing events that people are experiencing. Like, how can we support them? So I think the burnout, in my opinion, comes from being scared. Can I or can't I talk about what's going on?
I mean, I think it's
Dr. Jestovich.
I think it's a very multifactorial issue. Certainly dealing with chronic unrelenting stress and high demands and wanting to do good for everybody contributes to the burnout. Certainly the COVID pandemic add a whole other layer to it. But the main thing is that I think this work helps to address is stopping the stigma and having resources available. We need to talk about mental health just like brain health. We were red all of October for heart health. We need to talk about brain health and that we too, our brains get sick. And in fact, we're at a probably higher propensity. So these higher risk professions, I think we need to do more to support and just get rid of the stigma so people can get the help they need. Because the latest statistic I saw is that we lose nearly one physician per day in the U.S. to suicide.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Next up, Representative DePell.
Thank you, Chair. And I wanted to agree with Representative Hewitt that there are mountains of paperwork that physicians have to deal with both on a daily and a weekly basis, much of which doesn't contribute to the patient's health and has continued to be a burden that grows and grows. But it's also multifaceted, as the testifier mentioned. These issues can be complex, but when you're faced with limited time, limited resources, and work that you don't actually believe in, which is that mountain of paperwork, whether it's with OSHA, you could be fearing that OSHA would come in and shut down your practice because there's a loophole that you weren't even aware of, or that you aren't complying with HIPAA law, and some breach happened, and now you're facing huge fines and really, really bad PR on a public side. So I think not only do we need to look at the mental health side of it in terms of being able to listen to and help, but we need to look at it from a policy perspective. Have we made it easier for physicians to do their job, or have we made it harder? Sometimes we pass laws here, whether on a state or federal level, that are well-intentioned. We think we're protecting somebody in the process. But in actuality, oftentimes we are simply just making it far more difficult for somebody to do the job that they love. They really want to treat those patients. They care about the individuals that they're trying to treat. And so I think part of this discussion should focus around how do we remove some of the excess stress that exists in their lives due to a mountain of paperwork and regulations that did not exist for a long time when they could focus on their patients. Thank you.
Vice Chair Ryer, if you'd like to respond briefly, then we're going to go to three more questions, and then we're going to lay this bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative DePelle. I appreciate your concern about the administrative burden, and I have never yet heard a provider talk about OSHA, rarely HIPAA. What they talk about is the burden of prior authorization, of claims processing, of claims denial, of billing issues. And so I'm all in favor of moving to a more simplified, perhaps a single-payer system, which would clean up a lot of those issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ryer. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I just wanted to say, first of all, I know that the burnout issue is very, very real, and thank you to the testifier for being here today. And I represent lots and lots of physicians and other healthcare providers, so I know this is a really big and serious issue. But I have always kind of wondered about this bill, whether this is the right approach, because it just seems like so little. And as I'm sitting here listening, I wonder whether we wouldn't be better off to approach the stigma through the boards, through the licensing boards, by having them take action in some way to inform the people that they license about the availability of services, and having them do more to reduce stigma among licensees, because after all, they are presumably in contact with everybody who has a license in every area. And in fact, there is a program, I'm struggling to kind of remember it, the health professionals, maybe Ms. Clarkvist can help me out. There's a joint program that the licensing boards all participate in for licensees who have, talking about the health licensing boards now, for folks who have mental health concerns, for folks who have maybe addiction problems, to going back to Representative Gilman's question, there is a way for folks to, even if they have what could be pretty serious problems, to be able to get the treatment they need and get some supervision while they recover and be able to stay in the profession if they so choose. So, I mean, that is available, but obviously the problem is very, very big. I do want to, and I was just going to say this before Representative Breyer did, I think part of the problem here is the way the practice of medicine has changed with prior authorization, with what Representative Hewitt asked about, you know, the incredible burden that's put on healthcare providers, and the multiple insurance companies they have to deal with, all of whom can have different requirements, so that instead of doing the thing they want to do, which is treat patients, they're having to deal with this incredible bureaucracy. So I think simplifying the system is for them is one of the big things we can do, but certainly not the only thing. So thank you for bringing the bill.
Thank you. Thank you. Next up, Representative Zeleznikar, please.
Thank you, Chair Bierman, and thank you, Representative Breyer, and to the testifier. When I look at this, it's talking about workforce fatigue, and I guess my question is, do you feel as a physician that in your coaching,
that you're seeing, and is the increase due to just coming out of a pandemic? You know, that scope of it, because, or you see it beyond. And I thought the answer would be that by your head shaking. I know that having been in healthcare my entire life, it's a shift work. It is a high stress, regardless of a pandemic situation. And when I look at this, I feel like we need to, the situations when I talk to physicians and talk to nurses, they're working, they have to do all the regulatory charting requirements, but they also have to deal with the dynamics that happen in a day. So if they're short, if the nurses, if they don't have the team that they thought they had the day before and something changes and the staffing is different the next day, that workload has to be spread because you still have the 28 patients that you're set up to see today on Monday. And so the doctor's now helping be the nurse and helping be they're doing multiple roles. And that's something I'm curious if you're seeing that, because that's what I'm hearing in critical access hospitals. The hospital administrator's working the night shift as an aide. The director of nursing, the physician is working in multiple capacities. They might be helping on an ambulance run. They're literally being spread so thin that it increases the threshold of stress in that shift, and then it's not just situational, it ends up being days that you're doing this. So I'm curious on your feedback on just covering multiple positions.
Dr. Justovich, brief comment.
I just have to say, people in healthcare are doing it because they have great care and compassion for the folks, and they have the aptitude to do the work. And when you're unable to relieve the suffering, there are more people than you can deal with, that's very stressful. One thing that, besides just the overwork that is very common, and again, I know it's not just in healthcare, a lot of industries are feeling burnt out and really spread thin, but something that we often don't talk about, but I think is really important, is the trauma that we deal with. You know, you're dealing with life and death news that you're sharing with people. You're hearing the wail of a parent who lost their child. And then you're expected to go on to the next room and, you know, do an emergency C-section, for instance. That's exhausting, especially when you're really compassionate. And I think that's a real huge piece of the burnout and, you know, mental health issue that needs to be addressed. And I think we just need to face it head on. Like, we too are human, and we need care and support for this high-risk work that we do.
Thank you. Representative Zadlaznikar, was there a follow-up? Very good. Next, Representative Van Binsbergen, and then we'll move the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like I said earlier, I've been in this business for probably close to 20 years, and I understand the burnout rate in healthcare. It's a serious issue. The clock never ends in healthcare. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and but you know, there, like the other people said here, there is burnout in all industries, and my question revolves around, you know, what effect, you know, for this grant, you know, what, how many people are you going to affect? Do you estimate what kind of effect you're going to have? You know, it appears to me that it isn't. You know, other representatives have made comments about some ideas. For me, it was about the rules, the regulations that were placed on me in our business, and we had huge turnover, and it was all it wasn't the insurance companies causing the problem. It was the rules and regulations that were coming from, that were being created here. So, but my question is in regards to this grant, and how many people do you think, how many dollars will it take to affect each person?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. That I did not bring with me, and so I will follow up with you.
Thanks.
Follow up? Good. All right. Closing comments, Vice Chair Ryer.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, everyone, for your comments, and thank you for sharing your story. So we've heard about the human cost, the community impact. We have a solution here that makes a difference, one caregiver at a time, in an easy and accessible way. You can get more information for caregivers at treatyourselffirst.org. And to echo Representative Keeler, to the public, 988 offers 24/7 judgment-free support for mental health, substance use, and more. Text, call, or chat
988 if you're looking for assistance. Thank you all.
Vice Chair Ryer, that you brought a bill forward that a lot of people wanted to discuss. So we're a little behind schedule, but I think it's an important conversation. I renew the motion that House File 1645 be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill is laid over, and we will move to next on the agenda, House File 1885 from Representative Perez Vega. Welcome to the committee, Representative Perez Vega. I'll move the House File 1885 before the committee with the intent to lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Perez Vega, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here to pass through to present HF 1885, a bill relating to health and appropriating $100,000 in fiscal year 2026 and $100,000 in fiscal year 2027 towards the Commissioner of Health for Beauty Well projects for public awareness and educational activities to address the issues of colorism, skin lightening products, and chemical exposures from skin lightening products. This would be a one-time appropriation. And, you know, when we're here to discuss skin lightening, it's a pretty common in our communities of color, specifically women of color, men of color, to fall into the gaps of what colorism is. Skin lightening, whitening, and bleaching products are widely used and a common practice in many parts of the world. These products significantly affect both men and women in the USA and globally, posing both public health and environmental concerns. Skin lightening is a practice of using pharmaceutical active ingredients for cosmetics purposes to whiten the skin, including the face, hands, and legs, and any parts of the body. Skin lightening products come in different forms, creams, soaps, some cases injections, and commonly contain harmful active ingredients, such as mercury, hydroquinone, steroids, arsenic, glycolic, and other fruit acids, which do not appear on the package or the labels of skin lightening products that you can find in anywhere from a small bodega to online accessibility. Toxic skin lightening creams are used to attain unrealistic beauty standards. The global skin lightening product industry has an estimated market value of $9.2 billion in 2023, and is expected to reach $14 billion by 2032. The toxic idea that darker is somehow less than and very real consequences of colorism have created a market for skin lightening products, as well as feeling the isolation as young girls of color who portray themselves to thinking that being whiter is being more informative, professional, beautiful. As a mother of a young girl who has the beauty golden skin of what she has from her African diaspora all the way to her Latinidad, I'm asking folks to be conscious and sensitive to the members that are going to talk about these issues. With that, I'd like to open up and be joined by my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Perez Vega. And first up, as a testifier, will be Amira Adawi, Executive Director of Beauty Well Project. If you would please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and member of the committee. My name is Amira Adawi. I'm the executive director of the Beauty Well Project, which is a nonprofit organization that has been addressing this issue for several years. Skin lighting products consist of many forms of products, and the methods that people use to change people's skin is people mix multiple products containing mercury, hydroquinone, lead, and steroid-based creams, and they use 2 to 3 times a day and at home. And also, the reason that we're so much worried about using at home is that exposure has been increasing to the whole family. It's not now limited to those who are using, but also the whole family at risk of getting exposed. And we know that through the biomonitoring research that the Minnesota Department of Health has been doing over the years, through BeautyWell, MPCA, MDH, tested more than 500 products, and many of them contained high levels of mercury, ranging from 10 parts per million to 59,000 per million levels of mercury, which exceeds FDA's threshold, which is one parts per million. So we know that mercury is very toxic and the health impact is huge, which increases the health disparities for communities that have been using these products. And we know that now mercury poisoning has been happening. Just last year, the Department of Health had 10 cases of mercury exposure, which included children that was reported through the health kits study that the department has been doing. So we know that exposure is happening, and so we have been doing outreach to educate communities and refer them to healthcare providers, which increased more referrals for MDH and other poison control centers. And so we want to continue the work that we have been doing to address this issue and make sure that we decrease the demand and hopefully get an actual regulation, because right now there is no regulatory system that's addressing, and so people have access to these products. And so education and outreach is such an important thing that should continue. And thank you so much for the support of this bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Adawi. Next up to testify, Anjuli Cameron. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to address you today. For the record, my name is Anjuli Cameron, and I am Chief Executive Officer of SEVA AIFW. SEVA was founded in 2004 to serve the underserved and vulnerable immigrant and refugee populations in Minnesota. We represent the South Asian community with heritage in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Bhutan, Sri Lanka, Nepal, and Afghanistan, along with many other communities. SEVA serves the community through senior programs, youth supports, gender-based violence interventions, artistic healing, economic development, and most significantly, in our community-free health clinics, which includes vital support for heavy metal screening and testing services that are so desperately needed by our community. I'm here today to advocate for the passage of House File 1885 to support the Beauty Well Project in carrying out its public awareness and education activities on skin lightening products and the chemical exposures of skin lightening products. The use of skin lightening products within the South Asian community and many other Asian Pacific Islander communities is a complex issue, often driven by cultural beauty standards and societal pressures. However, many of these products, imported and unregulated, contain dangerously high levels of heavy metals. Many Asian women who use these products are also of childbearing age, and the potential transfer of metals from mother to fetus have lasting implications resulting in neurological and kidney disorders. Within the South Asian community, there's an intense pressure to conform to cultural beauty standards that often equate lighter skin with success and attractiveness. This pressure is deeply rooted in historical and cultural biases that drive skin lightening creams into our community, even when individuals are unaware of the potential safety issues. Our SEVA Health Clinic has seen firsthand the devastating effects of this pressure. We have conducted screenings that reveal alarming levels of heavy metals, even in young girls. Education and awareness are critical in the strategy to counter these deep-seated societal pressures. To prevent harmful exposures, we need to educate consumers and public health administrators about the significant dangers of skin lightening products. Their ubiquity is seen widespread in advertising and is a common household presence within South Asian communities in Minnesota. This underscores the urgency of this initiative. This is not simply a matter of education, it's a matter of prevention. We are talking about protecting children, families, and our community from irreversible, life-altering harm. The Beauty Well Project is recognized internationally as a leader in this critical area and has already demonstrated the tangible impact of raising awareness and successfully removing dangerous products from store shelves. The expertise and dedication is essential to our efforts here in Minnesota. I urge you to support this bill. It's an urgent call to action to safeguard the health of our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cameron, for your testimony. Any other members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? Please introduce yourself to the committee, and if you would keep the testimony to 2 minutes, that would be much appreciated. Thank you.
Yes, it's pretty brief. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Barbara Sue Hall, and I'm a St. Paul resident and an entrepreneur who works with nonprofits focused on public health, as well as small business development. Two of my clients are Asian Economic Development Association and the African Economic Development Solutions. And so, you know, as has been said, small businesses are impacted by this as well. I tremendously appreciate the opportunity to speak with you all today in strong support of the Beauty Well Project and the legislation introduced by Ms. Perez-Vega that would sustain and expand Beauty Well's essential work across Minnesota, particularly in areas where these products are increasingly sold and being used. Beauty Well addresses a widespread, urgent, and very preventable public health issue, one that, as has been said, disproportionately impacts communities of color and immigrant families. Toxic skin lightening and personal care products containing mercury and other dangerous chemicals are still widely available despite being banned at the state, federal, and international levels. These products are heavily marketed to Minnesota's African American, which I am, Asian, Latino, and Middle Eastern communities, reinforcing harmful beauty standards rooted in colorism, as has been said several times. Many Minnesotans who use or sell these products don't know they contain toxic ingredients or understand the harm they pose to public health. But the danger isn't limited just to the user. As has been said, mercury vaporizes into the air, placing families, especially vulnerable infants, children, and elders at risk, making this a serious public health issue. Beauty Well is the only community-based organization in Minnesota, and probably the nation, focused on this issue. They educate families, youth, and also small business owners, many immigrant-owned businesses, most of whom are unaware that selling these products is illegal and carries penalties. So this is also about their economic viability. Also, Beauty Well is a partner with MDH and fills critical gaps in public health research, education, and outreach. And so with this, I urge you to vote yes on this bill and invest in Beauty Well's critical work and in our richly diverse community's health and well-being. Thank you so much for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Suhal. Members, any discussion to the bill? Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. So one quick question I have. I believe the testifier you just spoke, did you say the products are illegal currently?
Well, mercury products are banned. However, as was mentioned, they're not on the labels. And so when folks buy it, when small businesses buy it to sell, or they bring it back to sell, they don't know that it has mercury in it and it's banned. And so part of Beauty Well's work is working with the small businesses and doing outreach to them and educating them and then buying the products and testing them because oftentimes, you know, no one knows until you test them.
Follow up, Representative Gilman.
So my follow-up is this. If it's banned or illegal in the United States or in Minnesota, I'll just talk about Minnesota, I'm guessing that folks are getting their products from overseas or different, you know, websites, things like that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd like to pass to my testimony.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative. So these products are imported into the U.S. illegally. They are also available through online. MPCA has been testing products that they bought from Walmart, CVS, some of them, and online. And then also through Beauty Well, we buy products from ethnic stores and malls and regular small shops that sell these products. So they're widely available, and we don't have a strong regulatory system in the U.S. FDA just started doing some regulation, but most of these products are illegal. However, steroid-based products are prescribed by doctors, and so when people start using these products, they become addicted to it. Some of them, they can't get prescriptions, so they fall back to the market, the black market, and they buy these products. And we have seen that some of the cases, people that we work with, they developed Cushing's disorder because of the usage of steroid-based creams.
Thank you, Ms. Adawi, for that.
Mr. Chair, can I also follow up with Representative Gilman?
Very briefly.
Yeah.
We need to move on.
Thank you. You know how accessible it is to go on Amazon and maybe just search for anything, right? Well, you have folks that see about these products taking it on an advertisement that they could go straight to their application, and we think about these 18-year-olds who are old enough to now be in college and maybe get their card to shop online while they're at campus, and that's what you see in these in what's happening illegally, right? And so this is an opportunity to really bring awareness in regards to what's accessible, what shouldn't be.
Representative Mahmoud.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you guys for bringing this forward. This is really important. I have seen the impact that this has on so many of our communities. I just want to understand, what does outreach look like for you guys? What is the plan?
Yeah, so.
Ms. Adawi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. So outreach, we have been doing outreach in ethnic malls, training businesses. We have been doing training for healthcare providers. We have been doing trainings for young girls. For the past 5 years, we have been recruiting young girls from public schools, charter schools, to build their self-esteem so that they don't start using these products by way of prevention. And then we have been doing outreach to libraries, public libraries, in communities, health fairs, to make sure that we collect these products and test. So now, as of 2023, we have a database where we test the products and post the products and then train communities to bring these products to us so that we safely dispose. The other thing is that there's no safe disposal system that are in place for them. And so we have to teach them that mercury is toxic, and so that it should be taken to the hazardous waste disposal sites. And so we do a number of activities in communities, as well as training public health providers. So in medical school, it's only 7 hours of environmental toxins. And so we also go into public health, medical school, pharmacy, nursing, to teach about this issue so that when they end up in their respected practitioner, so that they know how to handle and address this issue. So we do multiple approach in our education outreach.
Representative Perez-Vega, brief closing comments, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your time. This funding is important. We're raising awareness and educating the consumers about the dangers of light skinning products that contain mercury and toxin chemicals that are not essential to our health. So with that, I ask you to please check in on HF 1885. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Perez-Vega, I renew the motion that House File 1885 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and the bill is laid over. Next up will be Chair Stevenson, House File 1289, this next one on the agenda. Welcome to the committee, Chair Stevenson. And we are hearing this bill on an informational basis. No action will be taken. Chair Stevenson, to your bill, and if you could keep it all within 10 minutes, that would be wonderful.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this informationally. The committee report, I think, got tied up on its way over here. Went out of the Commerce Committee on a strong bipartisan vote, but we seem to have not gotten it out of committee report. So I appreciate you hearing it and hope that the committee will consider it. About 6 months ago, the United States Surgeon General called for social media platforms to have warning labels similar to those required on packs of cigarettes. This bill heeds that call and requires warning labels. The bill also requires social media companies to have pop-up notifications every 30 minutes informing the user how much total time they've spent on the platform. The evidence is very clear. Social media use has significant mental health impacts, particularly for kids. 95% of kids ages 13 to 17 report using a social media platform, with more than a third saying they use it almost constantly. Gallup found that the average teenager spends 4.8 hours every day interacting with various social media platforms. This isn't an accident or happenstance. Big tech does everything possible to make sure that people are staring at these screens as long as possible. It's how they make money. Several studies have found links between excessive social media use and poor mental health outcomes, including loneliness, depression, anxiety, sleep disruption, memory loss, eating disorders, self-harm, and even suicidal ideation. Public policy is failing. There's no guardrails on social media. I think that we will look back today the same way that today we look back on big tobacco in the 50s and 60s. We wonder, how on earth did they allow people to smoke on airplanes and have cigarette vending machines? They will wonder, why did you let teenagers stare at TikTok for 5 hours a day? Minnesota has been a leader in regulating social media. In the last few years, we've banned deepfakes, we've regulated kids working as social media influencers, and we've required big tech to disclose various statistics around social media use, including when they conduct product experiments on children. But more meaningful progress has been stymied by big tech every step of the way. This bill is not all we need to do, but it's at least something we can do that with bipartisan support in this divided legislature. Mr. Chair, I think there's at least one person here to testify, although I don't know.
All right. There, so I don't know where they... We will bring the testifiers up.
Maybe two.
We've got two. I've got two listed. They can both come up now if that would work.
That's fine.
And just please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed one at a time, please. We can go with Ms. Noring first, please. And we do have 2 minutes to testify.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon, sir, chair, vice chair, committee members. My name is Bridget Noring. 5 years ago on April 4th, I lost my son, Devin Noring, to fentanyl poisoning after connecting with a drug dealer advertising Percocets on Snapchat. That pill turned out to be 100% fake and killed my son. Tragically, my son is not the only one, and this crisis is still continuing to rise with our youth. This bill doesn't violate our First Amendment rights. It's not about politics. It's not about censorship. It's about awareness. Social media platforms are no longer just places to connect with friends. Our kids have become, it's become a hub where kids are being targeted by predators, drug dealers, and big tech's dangerous algorithms designed to keep them scrolling no matter the cost to their mental or physical health. As a parent who taught internet safety and etiquette to her child, my child was still harmed, and I can tell you Snapchat executives told me to my face I should have been doing a better job. If a warning label on a screen can make even one kid pause or put down the phone and take a break, it's worth it. If it can prevent even one parent from experiencing what I have lived through, it is absolutely necessary. A clear warning label on platforms like Snapchat would be a vital tool in helping parents make the best decision for their child when deciding whether or not to allow them on social media. It will also provide crucial information about the very real dangers lurking in these digital spaces and allow families to have more informed conversations about online safety. In a world where our children's lives are at risk, we can't afford to ignore these warnings any longer. Every precaution counts. Devin and many kids like my son did not have a warning. Maybe if they had, they'd still be here. So I'm asking you for my son and for every young life we still have the chance to save, please pass this bill. Thank you.
Ms. Doring, sorry for your loss and appreciate your testimony here today. Thank you, sir. Next testifier, Mr. Mishy, would you introduce yourself and proceed?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my name is Eric Mishy. I'm the CEO of SAVE, Suicide Awareness Voices of Education. We're a 36-year-old Minnesota-based national nonprofit that focuses on suicide prevention. I'll be extremely brief. This isn't about First Amendment. This is about protecting the lives of kids. We can tell you that time and time again, you can trace increases in suicidal ideation and suicide to the advent of social media platforms on a very broad basis. A month and a half ago, we, along with a handful of other nonprofits, launched a global campaign called Keep It Digitally Safe, which is now made up of over 35 nonprofits from four continents. This is an issue that goes on all over the world. Kids are finding themselves sextorted, sex trafficked. They're purchasing illegal drugs. We're seeing increases in suicidal ideation and suicide. If this is a First Amendment right for big tech to continue to target kids, we need to reevaluate what that means. The bottom line is this: this bill is not the end-all be-all, but it's a first step in making a serious effort to making sure parents understand that every click has a consequence and it's time to label the risk. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mishy. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we will have one member discussing it, and then we will move on the bill. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. Quick question, is it anywhere in the bill, I was just looking to see where it's stated what social media platform it is.
Chair Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, so we passed a law last year that included definitions of social media companies, so this relies on our existing law that defines social media companies and is careful to carve out things that aren't social media, for example, like eBay, you know, other platforms where people share content, but it's not traditional social media. This all was pretty heavily litigated when we passed the data transparency provisions last year, and I'm happy to, I'll send you an email when we're off here with the link to where that definition is in law.
Thank you. Chair Stevenson, follow-up?
Yep, and just a quick follow-up is just, you know, we do know that, again, you mentioned that in your opening statement on, you know, social media wanting to sell something or, and we believe too, I mean, I know myself, I believe that there's a social contagion that can happen and we've seen that. We've seen that a lot with just the impacts, especially of young girls questioning, you know, just even their own biological identity. So, I mean, I just, I'll be curious if this is going anywhere, what will happen with this, and thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. Final comments, Chair Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members, for considering this bill. I hope you'll include it in your omnibus. I know there is bipartisan interest. Representative Robbins has been a leader in trying to work to stop eating disorders on social media, which is a big threat. I've worked with other members. I think Representative West is a co-author on this bill. I have a bill with Representative Nadeau on cell phones in schools. There's bipartisan interest in curbing this, and I hope that that continues with this bill this year. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. And with that, we will move to the next bill, which is House File 1534. Representative Keeler brings this bill, and I will just say we will move your bill before the committee with the intent to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And Representative Keeler, I understand you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move the amendment?
Sure.
Representative Keeler moves the A1 to get the bill in the shape she would like us to consider it in. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? None. The motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Keeler, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Chair and members. First, I want to start off thanking Chair Bierman and both vice chairs for signing on to House File 1534, with me understanding that when we have access to healthy foods, it actually has a positive outcome when it comes to our health. What House File 1534 does is two things. One, it moves the Healthy Eating Here at Home program, often called Market Bucks, over to the Department of Health from the Humanities. It's often not made a lot of sense that food insecurities is in humanities, so we believe that the move to Department of Health makes sense, but also it builds off of the success of longstanding Market Bucks programs by expanding this nutrition incentive to grocery stores. So just so you know the difference, Market Bucks helps low-income customers who use SNAP stretch their food budgets at farmers markets. I don't know if you're like me, but we're a big fan of farmers markets in our community, and we love when we're able to use our SNAP food supports there. What this does is what I like to call federal couponing. When we utilize this program, we get a federal match, which actually means that we leverage other federal dollars into our local economies. What Fresh Bucks does is, while Market Bucks has been extremely popular, most of the time our farmers markets only take place during warm weather months. Many participants who want fresh or access to fresh fruits and vegetables year-round find that overly cost prohibitive. What this would do is expand what we're doing in farmers markets to our grocery stores. With that, I'll hand it over to my testifiers for time.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. We have two testifiers. If they could both come forward, Mr. Barthel and Ms. Walter, please. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon, Chair Bierman, Chair Backer, and members of the committee. My name is Steve Bartle. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Grocers Association. For over 125 years, the MGA has been a leading voice for Minnesota's food industry. Our membership includes over 300 retailers, food producers, manufacturers, brokers, and wholesalers. Together, the MGA members operate over 1,300 locations and employ over 150,000 people. We would like to express our appreciation to Representative Keeler for carrying this proposal, as well as bipartisan co-sponsors, Mr. Chair, both co-vice chairs and Representative Perryman for their support of this bill, as well as our friends at the Food Group for championing this legislation. As Representative Keeler laid out, House File 1534 aims to expand the successful Market Box program, which currently helps SNAP recipients stretch their fresh food budgets at farmers markets. This expansion pilot would expand the use of these to traditional grocery retailers, making it easier for SNAP shoppers to access healthy, fresh foods year-round. Fresh produce is crucial for good nutrition, but we also know that it's one of the most expensive food categories for low-income shoppers. The Fresh Bucks program would leverage federal funds to reduce costs for these essential foods, making them more affordable for SNAP customers who are already some of the most price-conscious shoppers in the grocery aisles. This expansion would also help provide much-needed support for retailers, particularly small businesses who are facing increased operational costs. Grocers are vital to their communities, but small retailers continue to struggle with rising expenses and the growing dominance of larger chains. The average profit margin for independent grocers is just 1.6%, so every little bit of support counts. Neighboring states like Wisconsin and Iowa have already implemented similar programs, helping local retailers and consumers. The Fresh Bucks program would be a win-win for Minnesota, benefiting both retailers and low-income families seeking to put more fresh food on their tables. Thank you for your time today, and we hope you will support House File 1534.
Thank you, Mr. Barthel. Ms. Walter, if you could introduce yourself and please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. My name is Tamara Walter. I am a single working mom of two in Blaine, low-income constituent voter, SNAP benefit recipient, and also user of the Market Buck program. I am for the Market Bucks program. As a SNAP benefit recipient, I get to participate in the Market Bucks program that helps me to make my dollars go two-thirds farther. The Market Bucks program is amazing every time you use it during the summer and the spring market, and we need to keep this program going. However, during the winter market, there is not access to fresh fruits and vegetables. This has a negative impact on my family, not having access to fresh fruits and vegetables with our health conditions. First, two-thirds of my family has type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, which require high protein and lots of fresh fruits and vegetables to keep our blood sugars balanced. Second, we also have celiac disease in our home. Celiac disease is an allergy to wheat, barley, rye, and oat, and is also known as gluten. Fresh fruits and vegetables do not contain gluten, so eat a lot of them. A Fresh Bucks program would be a wonderful addition to the Market Bucks program, which helps my family to financially afford purchasing fresh fruits and vegetables with the price exponentially rising. In conclusion, it is very important to keep this Market Bucks program going and fund the expansion of Fresh Bucks. Low-income families deserve the equality to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables all year long and keep us healthy. Please give the green light to Fresh Produce Bucks program. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Walters. Any members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to discussion to the bill among members. I do not see any, so we can go to Representative Keeler. Closing comments, please.
Thank you, Chair and members. I think this is a wonderful idea. I grew up in food insecurity, and I can tell you shopping in the middle of the grocery store, though it's reasonably priced, is not the best health outcomes. So this is a unique way for us to utilize the resources we have to support our local grocers, our local growers, and our local individuals. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. I renew the motion that House File 1534 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. With that, the bill is laid over, and Representative Keeler will stay in place for the next bill, House File 2707. We are hearing this bill on an informational basis. No action will be taken. I'll note there is a DE1 in your packets that was adopted already in the Human Services Committee. We will be discussing the bill as amended by this DE. We can go right to Representative Keeler to your bill to explain, and then we'll hear your testifiers.
Thank you, Chair. First, can I verify that we have a testifier online? Okay.
We do.
Thank you. So I'll start by just defining what sex trafficking is. I think that's really important for us in this space. Sex trafficking is the sale of a person for sex or sexual activities. In the state of Minnesota, Safe Harbor Law passed in 2011, ensuring that young people who are sexually exploited are treated as victims and survivors, not as criminals. 40% of sex trafficking cases involve youth. And I said this in my last committee, and I'll say it again. 40% of sex trafficking cases involve youth. Now, the next statistic I'm going to share, I think, hits our heartstrings a little bit. I want you to think about the 13-year-olds in your life. Often they're still little kids playing, maybe going to their sports, maybe trying to hang out with their friends. But the reality is that the average age of sex trafficking starts at the age of 12 and 13. This is a growing industry in our nation that is high-level criminal activities. The one way that we can support this is creating a navigator system to support our individuals who are sex trafficked across the state. This is not just a metro idea. This is not just a metro issue. Border to border, we have youth that are answering yes to the question, have you ever traded sex or sexual activity to receive money, food, drugs, or a place to stay? Over 5,000 high schoolers answered yes. The highest percent of yes is the northwest corner of the state. So what I don't want us to do is pretend like this is only a metro issue area. This is a border-to-border issue that we need to take serious, and we need to support our youth. With that, Chair, I'll send it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. And the first testifier will take from the table. If you could just introduce yourself, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Representative Bierman and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Ficori, and I'm the West Metro Regional Navigator with The Link. The Link is a youth and adult-led nonprofit based in North Minneapolis that provides a continuum of services, shelter, and housing for youth and young families who are experiencing homelessness, human trafficking, or involved in the juvenile justice or child welfare systems. We are also a partner in the state's Safe Harbor Response and No Wrong Door programming. Thanks to long-term bipartisan support from this legislator, Safe Harbor has grown over the past decade into an extensive network that includes partnerships across our state government and with nonprofit supportive services and shelter organizations, as well as our tribal nations and others. Services are available to youth through the age of 24. I am one of 11 regional navigators across our state. There are 9 programs and 2 tribal nations supporting the regional navigators. We act as the first point of contact to assist youth in getting access to services and support through our Safe Harbor network. We also coordinate with multidisciplinary partners and provide training, consultations, and technical assistance. Safe Harbor services are trauma responsive and designed to meet the unique needs of youth by walking alongside them on their path to healing, supporting their strengths, respecting their resourcefulness, and helping them imagine a bright future. As regional navigators, we hold a 24/7 crisis line for youth needing assistance, and through these crisis lines, we're able to help young people get direct access to shelter and supportive services immediately. In 2024, The Link received 640 crisis calls on our navigator line and served almost 100 of trafficking in our programs. In the last 3 years in my role, I've begun to see referrals for youth become younger and younger. We are now seeing referrals for youth as young as 8 or 9 years old. We also see youth who have had families, children, or pets threatened by their trafficker, and youth unable to access housing due to past criminal history as a result of their trafficker. It is critical for youth in Minnesota that this funding is increased so we can continue to provide services and shelter, and also to continue our work in providing prevention and education for young people about trafficking, exploitation, and their vulnerabilities. The exploitation of children and youth in prostitution is a horrific crime, resulting in short and long-term physical and mental health harms that not only impact the individual, but also families and communities. Children and youth are exploited in many different settings, including the adult sex industry, on the streets, and through internet, including social media and online advertisements. We also see youth engage in survival sex, meaning they trade sex for money, food, a place to stay, drugs, clothes, or status in a gang. Traffickers, facilitators, and buyers often seek out children and youth who are vulnerable due to their age, race, economic status, disability, identity, lack of supports, lack of housing stability, substance use, and history of abuse and victimization. It is easier to take advantage of someone who feels they do not have love or support or feels misunderstood and isolated. In some cases, family members are responsible for the exploitation of children and youth, sometimes trading their young relatives for money, rent, or drugs. A groundbreaking 2014 study led by Dr. Lauren Martin at the University of Minnesota called Mapping the Market for Sex with Trafficked Minor Girls in Minneapolis, Structures, Functions, and Patterns, found that the age of sex buyers called from police and court records ranged from 30 to 48, while the age of victims ranged from 13 to 16 years old. The buyers described in the study came from all types of backgrounds, including business professionals, with many living outside the city and coming in for work or travel. This is just one research example that illustrates a typical dynamic. Additional research is growing to show how boys are exploited as well through exploitation and trafficking, but services and resources have not yet caught up to meeting their needs here in Minnesota or elsewhere. As a regional navigator, it's my duty and my calling and my role to be the first person those youth come in contact with. And so we're asking for additional services to provide mental health therapy, chemical dependency, counseling, and educational programs. An additional $2 million to expand the current regional navigator programs we have. This funding is critical to the young victims of trafficking in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ficori. We have a testifier online now, Ms. Jones. If you could please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed.
Hi, my name is Esther Jones. I want to start off with a thank you to Chairman Bierman, members of the committee. I was groomed at the age of 17 through 19, and a result of that, I had a daughter. I met the link through the Hennepin County. They had me trying to do a thing for shelter, and it wasn't working for me, so I was homeless with my daughter for at least a year and 6 months. And I don't have family down here or support system. The link gave me that. It gave me hope, so I was able to do it by myself. It gave me my faith back. I am now a teacher assistant, and I am now the face of my committee of SAC at the link. I see more youth younger than me going through the same exact thing or worse, and I would like to change that. We have the people, we just need the funds.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Any members of the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, discussion to the bill among members. Seeing none, we're picking up a little time here. Appreciate that. Representative Keeler, final comments, please.
Thank you, Chair and members. As I stated in the beginning, 40% of sex trafficking cases involve youth as young as ages 12 and 13. And we've heard from our testifiers that we're seeing this happen in our state as young as age 8. I'm a mom of an 8-year-old, and I just can't even imagine this being something that happens. And so it's our opportunity to lead with our heartstrings and do what is right for the youth and the victims of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler, for the bill and your work in this area. And with that, we will move to the next bill, House File 1675, Representative Purcell. And Representative, I will move your bill, House File 1675, before the committee with the intent to lay it over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And Representative Purcell, I understand you have the A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Purcell moves the A1 to get the bill in the shape she would like us to consider. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Representative Purcell, to your bill as amended, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bierman. Thank you, committee members. The A1 amendment is just a technical amendment from the department to ensure that there's a 50-50 state and federal share for this funding, and it corrects a drafting error on page 4. So thanks for getting the bill in the shape that I would like it. House File 1675 seeks to expand access to home-based phototherapy, Billy Rubin lights, as I know them, the non-technical term, treatment for newborns with jaundice. Newborn jaundice affects 60 to 80% of all infants, and 2 to 6% require treatment. Phototherapy, the standard treatment for jaundice, is safe and effective at home with the proper medical support. The problem we're trying to solve is that currently there's a lack of home medical equipment providers who offer phototherapy services because there's such low reimbursement rates, and it doesn't even come close to covering the cost of providing these services, causing many newborns and their families to have to be readmitted into the hospital to receive the treatment. This creates additional and unnecessary medical costs and stress for the families. Without access to home-based care, families face hospital stays averaging 3 days at a cost of maybe $10,000. This bill seeks a reimbursement rate for home-based treatment at about $750 per infant. This is a huge difference. Some back-of-the-napkin math, there were 61,000 live births in Minnesota in 2023. Just on the low end of that jaundice rate, if we say 2%, there are a minimum of 1,200 babies that need phototherapy treatment every year. At $10,000 per course of treatment in a hospital, that number would be $12 million on the low end. Possibly up to $37 million on the high end if the service is only available in hospitals. At the proposed home-based rate, this totals out to $900,000 on the low end, $2.7 million on the high end. So we know that there's a mix with commercial medical assistance in these numbers, so we don't have a true exact savings, but this is something we hope the department could find in a fiscal note. Providing this treatment at home will not only reduce costs to our healthcare system, but it will ensure parent-baby bonding and breastfeeding and reduce stress for parents. This will also free up hospital beds, as well as mitigate risks of complications and infections. My firstborn came a little on the early side and was jaundiced, and for rural Minnesota families, this is a more affordable, more accessible, and I hope that we can get this provision across the finish line. And Mr. Chair, I have a couple of testifiers here.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. And if you can choose who's going first, if you would just introduce yourself to the committee and please proceed with your testimony, and you have a couple minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Cami Ozender, and I'm with Pediatric Home Service. I am testifying to request your support for this bill so we can improve access to home-based treatment for hyperbilirubinemia, that was my challenge for the day, or jaundice in infants. We can do this just as effectively at home for about 10% of the cost of a hospitalization. As Dr. Chawla will testify, hospitals are challenged to find home medical equipment providers, and the reason is very straightforward. A home care provider simply cannot afford the costs of both the provision of the equipment and the services that are required to do this safely in the home at the current rate of $76.55 per day. This bill establishes a two-code rate methodology that supplements that current reimbursement. The second code proposes to reimburse at $520 per care episode, which accounts for the additional service requirements in addition to the acquisition and replacement of the equipment. Using the average 3-day treatment period, the proposed episode rate under this two-code methodology is $750. Less than 10% of a hospital-based care. You may be wondering why not just increase the daily rate and avoid the hassle of a two-code system, and the explanation requires a very brief history lesson. Under 2018 federal law, states can only claim federal matching funds for certain medical equipment, including phototherapy equipment, up to the Medicare fee schedule amount. If the state chooses to pay more than the Medicare fee schedule, it must make up that difference with state-only funds. This bill provides a second service code that is not limited by that federal funding cap, allowing us to establish a sustainable reimbursement rate that will increase access to home-based treatment, save thousands of dollars for every infant needing care, and also ensure we're maximizing those federal funds that are available. I ask for your support and am happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Ender, for your testimony. And if you would introduce yourself and proceed.
Yes, Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Gigi Chawla, and I'm the Chief of General Pediatrics at Children's Minnesota. Thank you for having me here today to express our support for House File 1675, which would establish a sustainable rate for medical assistance coverage for home-based phototherapy services and equipment. Children's Minnesota is the state's largest pediatric health care system, and nearly 50% of the services we provide are to families that rely on Medicaid. In partnership with the Children's Health Network, we care for more than 7,000 newborns each year.
Roughly 80% of newborns present with an elevated bilirubin level, which causes the skin and whites of the eyes to look yellow, a condition we typically refer to as jaundice. In most cases, this condition is not severe, and the symptoms resolve naturally. But for some newborns, treatment is required to avoid serious complications that could lead to brain damage, intellectual disabilities, or issues with hearing and vision. Phototherapy is the most common form of treatment for jaundice and involves exposing the baby's skin to a specific wavelength of light for typically 2 to 5 days. It is possible for newborns to receive this treatment at home, with studies showing that home-based phototherapy treatment is just as effective as inpatient treatment when families have the proper equipment and clinical support. We are proud to offer home-based phototherapy treatment for patients and families as part of our home care program because we know it can improve outcomes for infants and support parents' ability to continuously care for and interact with their child, enhance bonding, and support opportunities for breastfeeding. Unfortunately, providing this service is proving to be more difficult because of the costs associated with accessing home phototherapy equipment. If families can't access care at home, then their child must be admitted to the hospital, which is less convenient for a family and ultimately more expensive. An inpatient stay for this treatment is more than 10 times the cost of home care. Requiring medical assistance to cover this service at a sustainable rate is critical to our ability to continue to offer this home-based option to our patients. Thank you, representatives, for your time today and your leadership on this important bill, and thank you all.
Thank you, Dr. Chali, for your testimony. Any members of the public wishing to testify at this time? Seeing none, member questions, discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Purcell, comments with this good bill before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say this is a really great bill and appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. With that, I renew the motion that House File 1675 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. With that, it is laid over. And members, we have arrived at the last bill of the day. Representative Chair Baker joins us. House File 3046, welcome to the committee, Mr. Chair, and I'll move the bill for you. House File 3046 before the committee with intent to lay over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Chair Baker, to your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, appreciate it. It's great being back at the committee. House File 3046 is about our communities and about the organizations that we all know and want to support with these little fundraising events. I ran into Chris Wenish, who's a person from my district at the grocery store here about a year or two ago. And Chris is a person who in my county inspects my breakfast counters at the hotels that I have, the pools that I have. He's a tough guy to get through these inspections. But he brought this idea to me that I thought had a lot of merit. So it's again, it's about sort of this double charging, I think, of these small groups, largely trying to make a few bucks to try to offer some hot dog stands, that kind of thing. And they pay a $20 fee to our local counties to have the inspection come out. But then the state turns around and sends them another bill, you know, for another 40 bucks that the departments, the counties report to them on an annual basis. So they send out another bill later on for 40 bucks. The idea is that we are saying now the counties, and it's very, very accepted widely that they want to see this fee removed for these little groups that get an extra $40 bill at the end of the year that we'd like to remove for that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifier. We just have the one today, and happy to take any further questions later on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. If you would please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Baker, for introducing this bill. My name is Chris Wenish. I'm a supervisor for Canandaigua County Public Health. We are delegated by the Minnesota Department of Health to license and inspect our local food, beverage, pool, lodging facilities within our county. And so part of this process is, besides the licensing fees that these establishments get from us, the Minnesota Department of Health has a hospitality fee. It's $40. That bill is sent out to them later in the year. Now, in this statute 157, Special event food stands are also included in this. So any small fundraising place that, like, selling some hot dogs for 4-H, trying to raise some money for your volleyball team, or any of these small activities for youth sports, mainly in our area, they're getting charged not only our $20 fee for the license fee, where we actually go out and inspect them and provide them education on serving safe food, but now they're also getting a $40 fee on top of that from the state, which comes to the surprise to them quite a bit. So our fear as a local delegated agency for inspections and other local agencies throughout the state is that this is a deterrent for people to come to us and get these permits for their food stands. And if that happens, then we increase the risk of potential foodborne illness outbreaks in our communities. Right now, we have a great relationship with our community members. We work really hard in our local public health agency to build that relationship. So they're not afraid to come to us and get the information they need, the licensing, so we can protect them. So we'd like to see this the special event food stands exempt from the statute, so they don't have to pay that. And then also, just as a community member, you know, some of our community members, they're putting their time into to raise this money for our youth sports and activities, so we can keep our kids active in that. But it's a financial burden when you're going to get the $20 fee from us, and then for each event you're going to get $40 fee from MDH. You do four events in a year because you're trying to help out your community. You're going to get a bill for $160, and you're going to be like, well, why am I getting this? And now it's just a deterrent to help raise funds for what we think is important for our small communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Renish, for your testimony. Any other members in the public wishing to testify? Seeing none, we'll go to member questions. And first on the list, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Baker, for bringing this bill. I have probably about seven of these doggone things booked this spring already. They might make $40, I don't know. That's what these things are. They're a great community, but I appreciate what the health department does here, because they do have to be trained. But realistically, these are groups that, like you said, volleyball, T-ball, whatever, and they really do need every dime they make. So I appreciate this. I don't know why we're not going to the floor with it, but I save that for the administration here. But this is a really good bill. Thank you, Chair Baker.
Chair Baker, I believe Rep. Hewitt said it all for you there.
Yeah.
Representative Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just was, the testifier said they have to pay the $40 fee. I thought it was an annual fee, but then they have to pay it repeatedly. Could you just explain that?
Mr. Renish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so for like a restaurant or a hotel or a public swimming pool, that is an annual fee that they pay one time. So these businesses for profit, they're going to pay that one time. But for special events, it's actually for each licensed event. So if somebody did several, you're allowed 10 days in a calendar year. So if you came through our county and you wanted to do two things for volleyball, two things for basketball, and then maybe somebody had some kind of a big health problem where you're raising money to pay medical bills, I mean, that's five events a year. You're looking at $200 extra that they're going to collect.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that explanation. And then, so you said you do the inspections in your county, and the county fee is $20. Does the $20 cover the cost of your time to do that inspection?
Mr. Renish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it does not cover the cost, but that's part of the relationship we're trying to build with our community. I mean, if we were going to try to cover a cost, I mean, it'd be going back to you're not raising enough money for what you're trying to raise money for those charities and stuff. So no, $20 helps us cover the cost for clerical work and inspections and stuff like that, and the education we provide, but it doesn't cover the cost. But we see the value in getting these places licensed so we can serve safe food to our communities.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just finally, so You know, that being the case, I don't exactly know here what the financial relationship is between the Department of Health and the local public health, but there is one. I mean, there is money that, you know, flows to both. So I guess I would say for this, you know, I appreciate the issue here and what you've described about the multiple charges. Maybe there would be some kind of middle ground where, you know, that this annual fee maybe gets paid once in a year instead of these multiple for the same organization. That would make a little bit of sense here. And I guess I assume this bill costs money. That's probably, you know, why we're not sending it to the floor, because it does have a cost. And of course, our Department of Health right now is under a great deal of financial stress and will be under a lot more probably as we see more cuts coming down from the federal government. So obviously it's probably not the time, but I certainly think what you've described sounds a little bit unreasonable, and maybe there is an adjustment that does need to be made. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Closing comments, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. To Representative Liebling's comments, you're exactly right. This came to us really late. I know there's a fiscal cost to this. We don't have that yet. So to that member, we don't have that information. What also Chris has brought to my attention is that usually they, at the end of the year, they submit their list of all the operators that they did an inspection with during that year. They send it out, the list, and then the state sends a bill out to those fundraising. Right now it's about a 60%. They actually get paid for about 60% of them, because a lot of them maybe just went away or they're not around anymore. It's a different treasurer, something happens. And now the new change with the governor's office, I think they want to make sure that they include it with each kind of a inspection right away. So it's a little bit more of an upfront payment. Then the county will pay on behalf of everybody. That's going to put more burden on the local counties. I was grateful we got a late hearing on this at the very end. I can say with my House file number, it's a pretty high number. I just received it. I can't thank the chair enough for giving me this chance to talk about this bill. And again, we'll keep working through the numbers and maybe the procedures about how to make this thing work for everybody. So I appreciate the time, and maybe we can be considered at another time. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Baker. I renew the motion that House File 3046 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. With that, I thank you, members, for attending today. This concludes our business. We are adjourned.